This is Pulse
Radio, LSCSU's official radio station. My name is Mike Pearson.
And my name is Christina Maisko.
And you're listening to the Interview Hour.
Each Friday between 5 to 6 on the Interview Hour, we'll be talking to distinguished figures from the fields of politics, current affairs, arts and academia.
We'll try and find out how they became interested in the field, discuss their career as a whole and talk about the relevant issues of the day.
You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/theinterviewhour or on our website at www.pulselsc.co.uk.
If you want to join us on Twitter, it's at Pulse Radio LSC, or if you want to email us, it's onair@pulselsc.co.uk.
We're joined in the studio by a Green politician who has featured in the Evening Standard's 1,000 Most Influential People in London. She is London Assembly member for the Green Party and has been since 2000.
She recently stood to become London Mayor for the Green Party and came third, beating Liberal Democrat Brian Paddick. Jenny Jones, welcome to Pulse Radio.
Thank you.
Now, many people know you from, obviously from the field of politics, but for much of your life you weren't involved as much in that. Please, can you tell us and talk about the period before you were in politics, because you were in archaeology?
That's right, yes. But I only did the archaeology from the age of 40. At the age of 40, I got divorced, and I left Herefordshire, where I'd been living for quite a long time, came to London, did a degree in archaeology, and did that for 10 years, and then I got elected at the age of 50. So I'm a late bloomer.
And how did that transition happen? Because it's quite a stark contrast between archaeology and politics in many ways. So.
Well, in fact, archaeology is absolutely cutthroat, more cutthroat than politics. Politics is easy by comparison with archaeology because there's so little money in archaeology and so few really good jobs. I absolutely loved it, though. I dug a lot in the Middle East, and that was a real freedom for me, and I loved it. I loved the people, I loved the country, I loved the food, and the archaeology is very exciting. So I had a great time.
But what was it about archaeology that first attracted you to that field?
Well, when I got divorced, I thought I want to go and do a degree, and I want to do an easy one. So I thought archaeology would be easy.
What's it?
Well, if you're interested, I suppose anything's easy, isn't it? And I was really interested, and I got a BSc. I specialised mainly in, it all sounds a bit esoteric, carbonised plant remains. So, you know, if you have a fire, you know, and the fire, of course, can be from any age. You know, it can be 10,000 years old or 200 years old, but you can look at the remains and you can see what people were eating, see what they were, you know, the sort of materials they were using.
And you mentioned previously how in archaeology you'd meet so many people who were travelling and
yes.
Very kind of, I guess, open-minded to different cultures. You must be if you're in that field. How do you find that contrast to the current political climate, for example, in which must be much more British than the world of archaeology?
Yes, I guess so. But, of course, as a politician, so many people approach me for help in various ways. I mean, they tend to come to me on green topics, but I've always done a lot of work on policing. I've always done a lot on policing, civil liberties, that sort of thing. Mm. I've also done a lot of work on road safety, which is a big passion of mine. So I get a lot of different people approaching me. It's true that most of the politicians I meet are British, but then you would expect that, you know, predominantly in this country. Mm. And that is changing, but changing very, very slowly.
Okay. When you compare the career path you've taken as opposed to, say, other politicians out there at the moment, how do you reflect on that? Do you think that they've missed out on something in their lives?
Well, not really, because, you know, I spent 20 years as a wife and mother, which I really enjoyed. I did bits and pieces of work, but I didn't have a career. And in some ways, that was excellent preparation, because particularly living, I lived abroad for some of that time, went to a lot of cocktail parties and that sort of thing, which is what you do when you live in countries like I was living in, and I got very good at chit-chat. And believe me, you can't underestimate chit-chat, just being able to talk to anybody at any time about anything. And I've got to say, the one topic that is of more use, the single topic that's more use than any other is football. I'm an Arsenal supporter, and being able to talk about the Premiership or the Champions League or even the lower leagues, you know, it's really, really useful.
Well, is that sort of instant sort of leveller between people, isn't it? Because most people have football teams, so they can instantly relate to it and
yeah,
talk for hours about it.
Fewer women, perhaps, you know, but then women quite often, I'm going to be really sexist here, operate on different levels, and, you know, you I find women tend to talk in a much more personal way very quickly. So if somebody's coming to me, a constituent, a woman will approach me in a more emotional way, and I find that easier to empathise with.
If you believe in that distinction, do you find that maybe politics is too much aligned towards the kind of male networking kind of atmosphere? And how do you deal with that? And how did you deal with it as a woman coming into political sphere?
Well, when I got elected at the age of 50 in 2000, it was an incredible shock. I didn't expect to get elected. As a Green, you stand for all sorts of things. You stand for your local council and as you know, for your parliamentary seat, but you don't expect to get elected. And getting elected to the London Assembly was a massive, massive shock. And it took me a year to get out of a sort of tailspin and understand that I was, or I wanted to do politics differently, and that it was hard getting recognition for that sort of politics. I'm a very cooperative person. That doesn't mean I'm a pushover, but it means that I want to get things done. And as a Green, I'm often the only Green on a committee. I have to work with other political parties to get things done. So I go out of my way to pull people together. And at first on the Assembly, everybody was very tribal, and it was quite difficult to break down those barriers. But over time, it has. And the women on the Assembly now, we work incredibly well together. I mean, clearly, we're all different political parties. We have different priorities at times. But we understand that if we, gang up, if we work collectively, we can get more done. And a case in point is we have a police and crime committee, and we hold the police commissioner for London to account and the mayor of London to account, and we're quite forceful. A lot of women on the committee.
So why do you think that dynamic works in the London Assembly, for example, but you compare that to the Westminster model, and that's very much them and us, and it's very party-based, partisan?
I guess it does. Well, it does operate like that a bit in Parliament, I would imagine, because you know there are times when you need to work together. Select committees, for example, I think there's a lot of cooperation there between political parties to get the right result. But on the Assembly, you see, we're only 25 people. That's a tiny group of people, and so, as I said earlier, I'm often the only Green on a committee, so I will mix more with the Tories, Labour, and other Lib Dem than I will with my Green colleague. There's two Greens on the London Assembly, myself and Darren Johnson, and I hardly ever see him because he's in all the other committees. We get together formally once a week just so that we can catch up with each other, but we do know each other very well.
And going back to the subject of women, is there any advice you'd offer to someone interested in politics now, female, who, and how to kind of understand how to maybe, obviously, like Mike was saying, Westminster doesn't perhaps have such a dominant female presence. Do you think that might change? How would that change in the future? Do you have any advice?
Well, I think we have to get more women, we have to get more ethnic minorities into political parties, and we have to make sure they get elected. Now, the Green Party is particularly good. It's not that it encourages women more than it encourages men, but I think it just lets women through more easily, because I think women are often quite shy about putting themselves forward for jobs, putting themselves forward to stand as candidates and so on. And in the Green Party, there is a level of why aren't you doing it? Rather than, we expect women to step forward and take these posts. So I think we have to develop that culture in other political parties as well. And the Tory party, for example, now I have Tory friends, I'm not completely biased, but the Tory party on the London Assembly, it has one woman out of nine members. I mean, that's, I think, quite shocking. Mm-hmm. Women struggle to get on in the Tory party. Mm. You have to be possibly much more aggressive. In the Green Party, you don't have to be aggressive to get on. But you have to work hard, and you have to be, somebody who can explain what you're doing as well. It's very important. You have to take the party with you.
Do you think it's quite sad, perhaps, that the kind of aggressive approach of the Tories is the one in the dominant party, whereas the more cooperative and you say maybe, but perhaps more supporting a female like mentality is not like the major party? And do you think that perhaps has a negative impact on politics as a whole within Britain?
It's got to. It must have a negative impact. you know, you can't represent a nation when you don't look like the nation, and Parliament definitely doesn't look like, you know, the average British group of people, you know, who are all colours and all nations. And so it really is time for Parliament to change. I did, I read just yesterday that Sadiq Khan, who's running the Labour election campaign, has said that there will be seats in London where they'll have women-only shortlists. That's a brilliant way forward. In the Green Party, we have a rule, for example, on the London Assembly, we select a list for that from within the party, and we have a rule about we have to have one man, one woman, and one ethnic minority in the top three. So, you know, I mean, the woman or the man might be the ethnic minority, but that's a rule we have. And so, you know, if we had three women in the top three, then we'd have to move a man up.
But do you think that's the right way to approach it in terms
of... how do you get equality? I don't know. It's the way that we're taking it forward, you know. No. If somebody's got better ideas, we'd be happy to have them. But we need more women in politics, we need more ethnic minorities. You know, it will change politics for the better.
Okay. And in terms of the Green Party and its political stance at the moment, is there anything that you'd like it to project, perhaps a greater message to the public, if there were a few key messages that the Green Party is working on, especially within your main areas of expertise? What would you want to just say to the public listening today?
Well, I think outside of an election campaign, you don't have key priorities. You have a whole manifesto of stuff you're working on. For example, I work a lot on policing. My colleague works on, Darren Johnson works on housing and planning. I would say to students that we don't like tuition fees and we would scrap them. We don't like what is happening to the NHS. We would protect the NHS. And we would like a different system for... You know, people seem to think on housing, for example, which is a real problem here in London, that the only way out is to start building everywhere and building on green space. We think there has to be some new build, but at the same time, you have to start thinking about refurbishing buildings and perhaps, you know, bringing buildings back into use. There's a lot of land in London at the moment that's not being used. Developers are sitting on land, not using it, because they're waiting for the price of land to go up. And we would do something about that. It's a policy called land value taxation, which I can explain if you want, but basically it means you pay the same in a tax whether the land is used for a big building or whether it's standing deserted, and it's an incentive for people to use land properly.
Do you think the Green Party is, in a sense, occupying a space that has been left devoid on the left of British politics, in a sense, because you had the Conservatives who moved to the centre ground, and you've got UKIP filling that gap, per se, and then you've got on the left Labour obviously moving towards the centre ground, New Labour, and post that you've got perhaps the Green Party moving into the space where they once occupied? Do you think that would be a fair reflection?
Well, I think we do have a lot of policies that socialists would like. I think if you look at all our policies, they make sense to somebody who cares about society, who believes that, you know, for a good, healthy society, we need to protect the vulnerable. And that means not pushing more and more people into poverty, which is happening at the moment with the changes in the benefit system, appalling changes, that's causing people not only to, you know, become poorer and poorer, but also probably we're pushing them out of London to the outskirts, which means the centre of London will be this rich enclave of people, and anybody you know who doesn't earn much is going to be out on the outskirts and having to travel farther and farther to their jobs in the centre. I'm absolutely appalled what this coalition government is doing. So I think you're right. I think there are a lot of our policies that you would call very left-wing.
Okay. Should we have some music? We've asked if you could recommend some songs just in the kind of Radio 4 style. I have to admit, probably, but...
In fact, music means almost nothing to me. I hardly ever listen to it. My partner plays music all the time.
It's surprising how many politicians say that. I guess it's a time thing as well. There have been a few politicians who've mentioned that they're not that keen on music, whereas obviously, I guess Frank Turner, as a musician, obviously had a long list of things that he admired, but it's just interesting to see how different careers tend to have different mentality towards, like, certain domains.
It's true. I mean, I am uncultured, very uncultured. I mean, I have a few, you know, I love female voices. Mm. And so I listen a lot to Nina Simone and Adele. And, you know, I'll listen to a woman's singing voice endlessly. One of my favourite songs is Here Comes the Sun.
It's very good. Anybody. By Nina Simone.
Yeah.
It's a very good version. I've actually been recently, I have phases of listening to the same music again and again on loop. So last week was a Nina Simone week, so I can definitely appreciate that choice. So Nina Simone, Here Comes the Sun.
This is Pulse. Welcome back to the interview hour. We're joined in the studio by Jenny Jones of the Green Party. Now, Jenny, the Green Party got the first MP in 2010 at the general election, with Caroline Lucas getting the seat. But since then, we've seen the rise of UKIP, say, and the Green Party are left in the other, you know, minor parties. Why do you think that the Green Party haven't excelled in the last few years?
It staggers me. We have really important people like Nicholas Stern, who advised the government on climate change. You know, a couple of weeks ago, he said he was really sorry, he got it wrong, he completely underestimated the impact of climate change, that either we spend billions now preparing for it, or we're going to spend sort of 20 times that, you know, fixing it in you know, a decade or two. So climate change is coming down on us like an express train, and you would think that people would understand that. The Green Party has some excellent policies for not only, you know, cutting people's costs and making life better, but also sort of, you know, future-proofing us, if you like. Actually, making sure we have a future that people will be comfortable with. Mm. and not struggling. So I don't know why, you know, UKIP gets loads of press and the Greens don't. Our MP, Caroline Lucas, is absolutely fantastic. We're incredibly lucky to have her. But we should have, you know, we should have 100 MPs. We should.
Do you think it's because the green agenda is being embraced by the main parties, and in effect, you are successful in that sense?
I think it's more that people don't understand the size of the problem.
Okay.
And, you know, it's very easy, as you say, for other political parties to have all this green speak. But actually, you know, it's rubbish. They just don't do it.
I guess one of the main things is, though, that with the economic concerns, that's so immediate and people see the effects, like, within just now, whereas with climate change, even though, like, mitigation might be necessary, obviously, but people don't see it as such an immediate thing, and therefore they turn to the parties that solve problems that seem obvious.
But, you know, when Ken Livingstone was mayor of London, he was mayor for 2 terms, for 8 years. And the second... we worked with him quite well in the second term, but in the second term, he actually needed our votes to get his budget through. So we quite deliberately sold him our votes. That's the technical term for it. We sold him our votes for millions of pounds investment in the sort of stuff that did cut people's household bills, but at the same time, they protected them from, you know, they reduced our CO2 emissions. And so, for example, you insulate people's houses. You do it for free. You get the money from energy companies. I mean, this is all happening. This is not a sort of a theory. This is, you know, there is a scheme at the moment happening. You insulate people's houses for free, and then you not only cut their bills, but you also reduce the CO2 emissions. It's simple. It's a win-win situation for human beings who struggle to pay their bills and for the planet. Mm. And we had all sorts of ideas like this. Ken was happy to take them up, but with Boris Johnson, it's been absolutely impossible to work with him.
And why so?
Part of the problem is, well, most of it probably, is that he doesn't have a philosophy. I mean, most political parties, most politicians have a philosophy of some sort.
Sure.
And Ken had a very clear philosophy, you know. And so it was easy for us Greens to see where our philosophy met his and where we could make suggestions for things he wanted to achieve. It was like wandering in a forest, and Ken knew he wanted to get to the other side of the forest, but he didn't always know the route, and we were happy to sort of say, oh, well, this way, this way, and we worked very well with him. But with Boris, he doesn't know where he, you know, he's just in the forest, he's just wandering around, and he's looking at trees, and, you know, it's impossible to work with him. I'm really sad about that, because, as I said before, I want to get things done.
Hmm.
And I haven't been able to with Boris Johnson.
It's interesting, though, how the media portrays candidates in such a different light, because you would never know, obviously, how a mayor approaches the process of creating policies, and it's not always easy to see if a politician does have a philosophy as such, because sometimes the policy is presented like as the finished result. But in terms of what you've experienced during the process, is there anything other than having a clear philosophy that you admire about a politician or a mayor?
I think you have to. It helps if you're honest. Now, I say that because I'm a fairly honest person myself. And what we see again and again is that people, for politicians particularly, I mean, Chris Huhne is a classic example. Politicians fall into the trap of thinking they can tell a little lie and get away with it. And Ken Livingstone is a classic example of somebody who just doesn't tell lies. And I know his enemies say that he's, you know, he does, but he absolutely doesn't. It's called undefended leadership, when you actually say about yourself the thing that people might say about you, you know. So you say, oh, you know, I earned, you know, £1,000 last week for a, you know, for a speech, you know, before your enemies start saying, oh, you're racking up all this money, you're making speeches, you know.
But I guess,
and honesty, it's really the best policy.
I guess the trouble with that is politicians can't win either way. You know, if you lie, then you're obviously hounded by the press. If you don't lie, come out with it at the start, then people say, well, that's you, just you trying to spin the story before it gets out there. So it's very hard for you to win either way, I guess.
I guess. It is a hard life being a politician, absolutely right. But I mean, I get into trouble from being so honest. It's true. But on the other hand, you know, I never trip up, because I'm always saying more or less the same thing, because it's what I believe. So I think in the end, you pay for fudging things.
And how much of it do you think is not so much telling the truth, but kind of let's just say, plotting a little bit within the assembly? Do you find that there's sometimes alliances between individuals, or just on a personal level, that it's quite hard to work as a politician?
No, not really. I mean, the Tories are the hardest group to work with in some ways, because they are the mayor's party, and it's, you know, it's hard for them to go against the mayor, although they do, and in fact they provide some of the best scrutiny for the mayor. I don't know if you know what the assembly does, but the assembly basically, we're not an executive body. We can't make things happen. We scrutinise the mayor. We watch all his policies, his strategies, his statements, and we make sure that they are coherent and that he's acting with probity and that sort of thing. So we're a scrutiny body. It's a very strange system. We don't have anything like it anywhere else in Britain. So it's not as if normally we can get, you know, we do a lot of excellent reports on things. We've just done an excellent one on cycling called Gearing Up, which, you know, advise the mayor, but the mayor can ignore us
in terms of the policies.
Very annoying.
For example, with cycling, how do you personally feel about it? Like, within your main report, you obviously propose to increase the accessibility of cyclist routes and make it safer. How do you think it's changed over the past few years? Is it positive, or?
Well, in 2000, when we started, cycling was actually, I mean, you know, a very limited mode of transport. But I worked with Ken Livingstone, and I was his green transport advisor for several years. And we got TfL, Transport for London, to do some really quite exciting things. And the cycle hire scheme that you've got just outside here, and the cycling superhighways, were all things that came out of a Transport for London report that I got them to do. And so, yes, cycling has gone. But the big problem is, we have a cycling mayor now, Boris Johnson, who doesn't really understand cyclists, because he is personally quite brave. So he just sort of cycles around London like a sort of, you know, and just shows no fear. He doesn't understand that for many people, particularly women, but men too, it's quite frightening out on the roads. And so as a new cyclist, it's a big challenge, and you feel quite threatened. What we have to do in London is to make cycling safe everywhere. you know, on the main roads, on segregated paths, on greenways, wherever. It's got to be safer. And at the moment, road casualties are going up for the first time in a decade. So we've got a problem.
Why do you think that is? Is that because of less effort from the mayor?
It's worse than less effort from the mayor, although that's part of it. He cut the road safety budget. If you cut... Road safety is one of those things, if you spend £1 million, you actually get something like £2 million of benefit, because you get... every death on the road costs something like £1.4 million in terms of emergency services, NHS services, social services, benefits and so on, going to, you know, the people who've been left. So it's very expensive to have people killed on the roads. And of course, you know, they, you know, if people are injured on the roads, it means they're not working for however long and so on. Mm. So it pays to make the roads safe and keep people safe. So the mayor cut the budget, but also he developed something called smoothing traffic flow, which basically meant making, you know, trying to get cars and buses and lorries and so on to go faster. And that's... it meant taking out pedestrian crossings, it meant reducing pedestrian crossing times and things like that. So it's had, you know, a bad effect, and we've just started seeing the rise in casualties that is the result.
Yeah. What policies of the mayor's do you agree with?
Yeah, I know, I'm moaning about it a lot. Well, not very much, really, not very much. I mean, he's a Tory, and...
Do you get on with him?
Personally, I've got no problem with him. He makes me laugh, he's funny. If you bump into him in the lift, you know, he's interested, he remembers, you know. I've got a canal boat, you know, he'll ask me about the canal boat. Or, you know, I mean, he's very personable, he's very funny. You know, I'm sure great to go to the pub with or go to dinner with.
I guess that's
his politics I loathe. And also I think he's somebody who has had this massive opportunity to make a real difference to London, and because he doesn't have a philosophy, because he doesn't have a sort of, you know, a framework to hang his ideas on, he hasn't done as much as he could. It's a wasted opportunity. Now, I resent that. I think there were people who could have done more.
And other than Ken Livingstone, who would you have preferred?
Well, obviously me. Obviously. A green mayor. Imagine. But he said he's going to stand down after this term, so... And I'm standing down. This is my last term of office as an Assembly member, so it'll be a lot of fresh blood next time.
How do you feel about leaving?
I've been planning it now for a year, and I've got another 3 years before I step down, but I'm going to do something completely different. I might just... I've got grandchildren. I might just spend more time with my grandchildren. I might grow vegetables.
Go back into archaeology?
Yeah. Actually, that might be an option, yes. Or, I don't know, spend a year in Damascus or... I don't know. Just... Who knows? Other opportunities, other things will come up.
Okay.
Now, obviously, climate change is the issue in terms of green issues, but what do you think are the sort of understated green issues, the green issues that don't really get much attention?
I think probably that climate change is having an impact on things that we're starting to spot, but at the moment we don't think of as huge problems. For example, food. The fact is, because of all sorts of freak climatic weather events, food is becoming more and more expensive. Harvests are failing all over the world. There's more competition for food now, and we're going to really feel that. I mean, the price of food is going up. It's going up faster than, you know, almost anything else. So we're going to have a problem. There's also the problem possibly of water, you know, whether or not we're going to start seeing water shortages. And here in Britain, we're fairly cushioned. We're a very rich country still. We're fairly cushioned from most of these big sort of impacts. But, you know, it is happening. There will be shortages.
I was reading a book called The Meaning of the 21st Century, which predicts many of the 21st century's events, and it did mention that it predicted that there were going to be wars over water in the 21st century. Do you think, scarce resources are going to be the big conflicting factor of the 21st century?
And energy, of course, you know. I mean, if we'd had any sort of sane government over the past... Well, the Green Party's been around 40 years, and for 40 years we've been saying, you know, it's really time to put lots of money into renewable energy. I mean, Germany's doing it now. I mean, you can't say that Germany is heading for economic ruin because it's decided to scrap all its nuclear and it's actually going to try and go so far towards renewables. You know, we should have been, putting money into wave power, tidal power, and we've just wasted. And we've had a lot of the ideas. We've developed a lot of the solar technology and so on, and we've not maximised it. And we could have factories churning out these things and selling them to other countries and generating jobs and wealth and future security. And yet we've missed all those opportunities.
Where do you think the main problem lies? Would you say it's the public not recognising it's such a big issue, or do you think it's the system of politics in Britain, perhaps?
I think it's the politicians we've had, I'm afraid. Some of them do. It's not only Greens who see how important it is to future-proof ourselves, but most don't. The people who've been actually governing don't. And, there are a lot of people out there who want to be greener and want to do greener things, and there's a lot of small businesses that people want to start up for all sorts of very green activities, and they find it difficult to get loans, they find it difficult to actually even start up. And that comes back to the banks and the fact they don't lend to small businesses, and they're obsessed with sort of generating money that doesn't stick to anybody's hands apart from the bankers.
But it's one of the main problems of the whole green agenda in the sense that it's green issues cross borders, essentially, and that whilst you have China and India still pumping out many greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, people in this country are going to go, well, what's the point of me stopping to drive say my 4x4 when the UK produces 1.75% of total CO2 emissions whilst they're building a new power plant each week?
If we did it seriously, I mean, in fact, the only, I'm told, I don't know this from first hand, but I'm told that the only bit of the car industry that's in growth is the small green cars. Those are the ones that are actually selling the best at the moment. If we went into green energies, green technology, we could sell it to those countries. China, I'm sure, would love to have cheap, photovoltaics and wind turbines and so on. We could encourage other people by example. We can't say just because, it's like saying, it's no good giving up smoking because the guy next to me is smoking. Well, actually, no, it's very good for your health. Think about air pollution in London, for example. We have a real problem with air pollution, and it's invisible, so we don't know it's happening. I mean, we find soot up our nose and on our skin, every evening, but we don't really think about what that's doing to us. But in fact, Transport for London figures show that over 4,000 people die early deaths every year because of air pollution here in London. We have broken EU limits so many times. Putney High Street was on the 10th of January had its annual limit for breaking EU targets. Putney High Street now is having special measures. Clean bus. They've cleaned the buses that are running through it. They're asking shopkeepers to close their doors to keep the pollution out. It's nuts. How badly polluted our air is.
Do people in Putney know about this? Do people in Putney know about this? This is.
Well, I think probably it's been in the local papers now. I talk about it as much as I can, but somehow the mayor's, he's put his fingers in his ears and going la 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 la, not listening. For example, he announced this week he was going to put in an ultra low emission zone into the centre of London, which Greens have been saying he should be doing. He should have done it a decade ago, but he's not doing it till 2020. So we've got 7 years of filthy, polluted air before then. The UN recently declared diesel particulates to be carcinogenic, and that's something we have a lot of. That is actually the sort of soot that you get, and it's really bad for our lungs. It's terrible for people with heart conditions or with asthma or anything like that. Bad for kids. Their lung capacity doesn't develop properly, and here we are. We're letting all these cars come in, and not you know, if we put in an ultra low emission zone, we could say to cars, okay, you know, you can get retrofitted. You get retrofitted, or why not catch the bus? You know, we should be cleaning up the whole bus fleet, the taxi fleet. Anyway, I could bore for Britain on this, but it is a real worry, and it's another reason to leave London, I guess.
We were looking at just figures like what you hoped in terms of hybrid buses and how the estimations far from the aim that you wanted. I think it was only 10% or something. I'm not sure about the exact figures, but how do you feel about just always missing the limits on so many things? Is there anything that...
It's infuriating. The mayor, Ken Livingstone, when he was in power, set various targets for carbon emission reductions for London. And we are now... So the gap between the targets and our polluting... It's opening up so wide that we can't achieve the targets anymore. And that means, you know, London is a polluter, and we're not only polluting ourselves, we're polluting the rest of Britain. It's really frustrating.
But then if you said that by 2020 he hopes to create this greener zone for London, but aren't you worried that maybe just the same thing will happen, that all these policies might be just stated but there's no implementation device to actually achieve the targets themselves? So
yes, of course, I'm afraid I don't trust Boris Johnson. You know, if he said to me, I'll go and get your coffee, I wouldn't trust him to bring me a coffee. That's the level I've reached, I'm afraid.
Isn't this, I guess, just a microcosm of the sort of problem of hierarchy, in the sense that, you know, you can't really get anything done unless you get the mayor's office onto it. You can't get anything done in terms of climate change if you get all the world leaders to agree on binding targets. And, you know, both, I guess, the mayor's targets, it just illustrates, in a smaller sense, how it's hard to get people at the top to agree to things when they've got people whispering in there about this interest or that interest.
Well, there's three rules of sustainability. I wrote them myself with a bit of help from Friends of the Earth. The first is that everybody has to do something. So you can't just say, oh, China's got to clean up its act, or the government's got to do something. Every single... As individuals, we have to do things, as communities, as, you know, as towns, cities, counties, nations. Every level has to do something, you know, because... Otherwise, the job is too big. So it does matter. Every time somebody recycles a bottle or doesn't throw away something and fixes it instead, that's a gain, and we should all be clear about that. So everybody has to do something. The second rule is that... Am I allowed to swear? Can I swear?
No? It depends what word, to be honest.
The second rule is no messes downstream. And this is something that other political parties, or something Greens are actually very aware of, that you can't fix one problem by creating another problem in 5 years' time. So, for example, all the biodiesel stuff. You know, biodiesel. Virgin, what's his name, Richard Branson, was saying, oh, we'll all fly... You know, all our planes will fly on biodiesel in, you know, a decade's time or whatever. Well, that biodiesel means that we're not growing food. It means we're losing forests all over South America and so on. You know, so actually, you're solving one problem, but you're creating another. So that's the second rule: no messes downstream. You always have to look at the impact of a solution before you can say it's really a solution. And the third rule is that there is no silver bullet. Al Gore says there's only silver buckshot, and that means that you can't say this is the solution. You have to understand that it's little solutions that are going to make the... You know, we need 1,000 solutions to all this, because it's such a complex problem. There is no one thing that's going to make it better.
Mm. But I guess that the fact that there's no one solution makes it far harder to incentivise people to do something.
Of course it does.
Because no one has a clear message in their mind just saying, this is what you're meant to do. Everyone's kind of... which is the better approach to take, or how big is the impact actually going to be? And there's so many questions within climate change that it makes it very hard to actually incentivise action.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, and I think this is part of the problem about putting the message across. But you can, once you understand there is a problem, and I think a lot of people don't even know there's a problem, then you can just you know, do what you can, you know. I mean, at least vote Green, you know, vote Green at every election. You know, we might actually get some more Greens elected, or, you know, don't use your car one day. Well, probably most students don't have a car, but don't use your car one day a week, walk or cycle instead. You know, there are little things people can do. This is also one of the problems for government, because governments love big shiny toys type solutions, you know, like HS2, High Speed Rail 2, you know, oh, this is going to solve loads and loads of problems, you know, economic problems and so on, and of course it won't. But they like the big toy approach, but actually it's the little toy approach that you have to take. You know, there will be some big toys, but a lot of it is little toys, like setting up small businesses, you know, locally, you know, like setting up, for example, you know, I mean, the green view of sort of how to develop your energy supply, a secure energy supply, is to make every single house its own little power station, you know, so that you are generating your own electricity in some way or another. You know, if, you know, a lot of houses now use solar, and, you know, that's absolutely fantastic. And even in Britain, it can make a big difference. Mm-hmm. And the length of time it takes to get your costs back are reducing. As energy goes up in price, actually you're producing your own energy, you know, makes your bills cheaper.
Sure.
So, you know, we can all do something.
But going back to what Christina said about public opinion, etc., how do you think that's come in the sense of, last, say, 20, 30 years, and how the Green Party added to that conversation, do you think?
I think that the Green Party's always... We've always had a slightly nutty sort of feel to us, you know, knit-your-own-muesli type, you know, sandals and beards and that sort of thing. And there is an element of that, because many of us want to be low-impact people. We don't want to use loads of the Earth's resources, because we know they're limited, and so we're careful and we're cautious. But at the same time, we've got some very big ideas. There's a website, it's called, I'm really sorry, I can't remember what it's called, it's something like Choose Your Policies or something like that. And the Green Party comes out top on loads and loads of policies. When people choose blind, so they see a load of policies and just pick the ones they like, Green policies do extremely well. Mm. Because in fact, most of the stuff's very sensible. Mm. You know, and I think people have not quite understood how sensible those policies are. So they have an impression of what the Green Party is, which isn't accurate anymore.
But about people's impressions, and I guess obviously the media has a huge impact on this, and the toy solutions that you were talking about with the major parties obviously go down pretty well in newspapers as headlines, etc. But if these sensible policies, how do you think the media should be portraying this, and how do you think the Green Party can improve its publicity in a way to make it clear that the policies are in themselves quite sensible, even though there's no headline as such?
As an Assembly member, I do a fair amount of media, you know, radio, TV and that sort of thing. And, you know, we get that media because we are talking about the stuff people want to hear about. And it's also incredibly important for us, because we don't have very much money, that, you know, it's a way of letting people hear what our policies are, because the other parties can put big advertisements up and lots of literature and so on. It's much harder for us with so little money. So doing media, getting media, is very important. And I think we do incredibly well. I think of all the Assembly members, Darren and I do way more media. You know, we're actually asked to go on shows to talk about stuff more than any other Assembly member. So there is an appetite for hearing what we've got to say. Mm-hmm. And I don't blame the media at all. I think it's very hard when you've got somebody, when you have a political party like UKIP that's saying some quite, you know, shocking things, and it annoys the Tories. We don't annoy anybody. That's a really, you know, provoking thing. We don't annoy the Tories the way UKIP does, and, you know, the way the far-left parties annoy Labour.
And in terms of Green, within a more international perspective, especially with the EU, what's what's the Green stance? How do you think also the climate change incentive interacts with the European Union legislation on environmental standards, and how does that dynamic work within the party?
Well, of course, I mean, we get a lot of excellent policies from the EU in terms of climate change, and also working directives and that sort of thing, so, and equalities directives. So there has been some fantastic stuff coming out of the EU. The Green Party's view on the EU is that we should be in it, but it needs radical reform. You know, the amount of money is wasted. Now, I personally am much more sceptical than that, and I think reforming the EU now is impossible. It's too embedded in its own ridiculous sort of money spending. You know, all this stuff about moving from Brussels to Strasbourg and back to Brussels, it's crazy. And I just don't see that they can break out of this, you know, of the format. And so I personally, if there's an in-out referendum, I'll vote to leave. But I am a minority in the party. Most people would vote to stay in.
Mm. It was a political thing the other night. It was Matt Ford's political party, and he interviewed Nigel Farage on stage. And Nigel Farage said he voted Green in 1989.
I saw that, yes.
Which surprised me, in a sense. But were the Green Party more Eurosceptic, and have they become more Europhilic, in a sense?
No, I think we've always more or less been supportive, because such good stuff comes out of it on the things we care about. Mm. But at the same time, Greens are very careful with money. You know, we have so little of it, we spend it very wisely. And we're the same with other people's money. So, you know, it does offend us quite a bit.
Okay.
Should we end on a song?
Yes, let's end on a song. So thank you very much for coming onto our show. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. Is there anything you'd like to conclude with, like a finale piece?
I'd like to say, well, my Twitter thing is at Green Jenny Jones. People are welcome to follow me. Don't be rude to me. Loads of people are rude to me. It's not very nice.
No, it's not very nice. You were mentioning how people know you before they actually meet you via Twitter.
Oh, sometimes people say, oh, I follow me on Twitter, I feel I know you. And it's quite a freaky sort of feeling, actually, that I've exposed what I'm really like.
The whole idea of Twitter is quite a freaky thing. You're following someone. It's quite a, by nature, quite a stalky.
Yeah.
I do blurt a lot on Twitter. I vent. So when I'm annoyed or happy, you know, I tend to vent. And that means it's quite personal. I don't just tweet about political stuff.
I see. So
Pulse Radio. Pulse Radio will be following.
Very kind of you.
Pulse Radio
doesn't say,
do
you know, even if you don't vote Green, I think you should really, really ask questions of the people who are seeking election. You know, you should always be sure that they have your best interest at heart.
Okay, that's a good message to end on. And now to end on a song. So
I wondered about Tosca.
Tosca.
Is that on your
database? Yeah, we can access quite a bit.
When I was a student, I used to pay £3 or something and go to the Royal Opera House and listen to Tosca. Even though I'm not that keen on music, I love the spectacle.
Which do you know which piece of Tosca you like the most? Because it's quite a few.
There are. Any of the arias, perhaps when he's dying at the end.
Okay. Right, I'm not sure.
That's quite powerful.
You mentioned that you weren't cultured, but I think we're far less cultured than you in terms of Tosca, so we'll just have to guess at a random aria. But here we have one. Hopefully this
one's at the beginning, actually. So
okay,
all right, thank you.
A beginning to a.
And thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for joining us. Join us next week at the same time, 5 till 6 every Friday.
This is Pulse.